Oh yeah, that's what I think. With all the footnotes and quotations.
Warning, applause, that I will not be talking about these versions that you expect them to be talked about. Indeed, I hope that they will be talking about the versions that you expect them to be talking about, and maybe that is because I can sometimes get charged them with doing that. What I do have to say is very much centered around law. That in a cyber environment, and when I think of the new millennium, it's hard not to think about a network cyber environment, law has many expressions. It's not just what, say, U.S. Congress might pass and President might sign that binds us in a way it's the very fabric of the software that binds us, and that's part of what I'm going to talk about today. So it's a different kind of law than you might be used to. And I want to start with a question, one designed to kind of take us out of the woods and the trees and actually get a bird's eye view of the forest. And the question, as I was thinking about what I was saying today, is this. We live in an information economy. That's so much of a truism that we take it for granted when we see statements such as that. We know it's an information culture. So much of what we're doing now about knowledge workers and information is thought of as so key to everything. We need to acknowledge, of course, that information, and maybe even knowledge, is power. So I wonder why libraries are worried about the right of an obsolescence. Now, you might say I'm already putting words in your mouth that is such a worry, but in the people I talk to in this community, it might seem to me, actually, quite a strong worry that libraries are being left on the sidelines. Somehow, information revolution is taking place, and not only is there a worry that somehow library visits are down, usage of libraries is down, according to some metrics, but even with respect to the Internet itself, looking at the Internet, a parallel engine of information dissemination, and yet I don't see libraries at its core. Now, why is that? Why is it that the first place somebody goes to for reference, they don't know what they're looking for yet, they have a general idea, they don't know how much the moon weighs, and they go on, and they don't go to a library online, they go to Yahoo, and they go to AskAlexa or AskJeeves. Indeed, some of the librarians have thought we have a personal vendetta against AskJeeves. Every question that is asked to Jeeves is a question that likely they should have been asked to them, and they're not Jeeves still away. And now we can say, you don't believe the answer that Jeeves gives. I mean, you know, how much does the moon weigh is the answer that is the sample. It's the type of question you're supposed to ask what it exactly type in. And if you're even very clear, like how much does the Earth weigh, you've already been somewhat confused. And I would hope that we can beat that standard if we try. So I offer two kinds of answers to this question. And then understanding you may not even accept the premise of the question. There are two kinds of answers. The first is what I call a funny business response. What is a bunnyless response? To me, a bunnyless response is a kind of parochial concern. It's saying, here we are, we're in an industry, we're in a business, we're in that business of being libraries, of doing references in libraries, and we're getting left behind. That's not bunny that left behind. We need a way to catch up. And again, that's what companies do whenever profits go down. It's what a bunnyless manufacturer becomes more good. As they saw more and more faceless carriages popping up in the road and saying, wait a minute, you know, we might lose our racket. We need to somehow figure out how to be one of the steering wheel manufacturers if we are to survive in the new era. Now, I think there are a perfectly good set of legitimate worries around the bunnyless problem. But to me, I think that the bunnyless problem isn't all there is. Here's an example of the bunnyless answer. The New York Times, Age Upstart College Board is joining Gold Rush on the web. I don't know how many people heard this news when it came out. The Medical College Board, the people behind the SATs and other acronymized tests for which somebody filled out in college and actually was told what their work is. The College Board has decided not to go online. And how is it going online with a .com venture? It's going to, for instance, when people go online, that's the first thing you think when they go online is, I can go online and get my score. And that's true. You'll be able to go online and score AC, you get your score. But there is so much more. You see, the college wants to be a term. As long as you're going online to get your score, it must be if you're interested in going to college. In which case, you must need brain furniture. So we're studying joint furniture. And so you might not use joint furniture, which means that it should be an option. You can have people who are taking the FAP train joint furniture with each other. And if it's true that you start thinking that way, you realize the possibilities are truly endless. But in given to Colin Ford as some of the business plans, for which they're seeking an American investor capital and partnership, I'm hoping that it's a serious business out of this. My explanation to New York is, hey, I pay up the website somehow, so that's how we're going to do it. But for me, it's a little bit striking as if working all day so you can pay the babysitter, you can sure that feels better than what you're working. You start wondering, well, what was the purpose of the website for which you need this kind of website to pay for it? So that's a different kind of question than the buggy book question. You could imagine, possibly, this being a successful website from the point of view of earning a college degree or money. But there might be other ways when you might try to express what is success for an online venture, particularly if the entity willing to take on the online venture becomes part of the online world, isn't just a .com. And I know, I hear odd noises in the room as well. They're working on it. Okay, so, about in the study of response, I offer a value response. My idea is that yahoo.com and, Our place in that world, to me, is much more effective to start thinking in terms of value before thinking in terms of raw competition. How do we out-compete the dot-coms of the world? So to me, that is something regresses to us. What do we stand for? Can we articulate together what we stand for? Now, there's a literature on things people stand for and things that institutions stand for. Business schools tend to tie them up into articles and case studies and such. They tend to transform values into core purpose. What's your core purpose? Your raison d'etre. And here's some core purposes that I extracted from one of the famous articles on the subject. Here's Cargill. I believe it's a pharmaceutical concern. To improve the standard of living around the world. Here's 3M. To solve unsolved problems innovatively. Actually, I can imagine ripping that off and having that be a kind of reference core purpose. Nike. To experience the emotion of competition winning and crushing competitors. Now, Fannie Mae checks more of his interest because Fannie Mae is a quasi-public, quasi-private entity. It's not just another lender that, at the end of the day, for purpose of five, has a simple return to make on investment and wants to maximize it as much as practical. Fannie Mae says, wait a minute, we are charged by the U.S. government, even if we're not really controlled by it, with some kind of value in mind that's apart from the typical dynamics of the market. Like a given, that has all kinds of dimensions to it. It means accumulation of knowledge for free. It's an access to knowledge. That has a combination of knowledge means. Does anybody have a claim to come in and ask a question and get an answer from which you assure? So if you do a company that is biopsy, either because you are looking to see how much money they have to pay for their answer, or you can have somebody with whom you contract. Perhaps a source in your library that that have restrictions on book distribution, that I'm sorry, it's only for a certain kind of students, or I'm sorry, it's only for people who subscribe and have a blue sticker on their car, just instead of a no sticker on their car. And if you can see, I'm trying to get the values that are more than just kind of excellence. Right? Everybody stands for excellence, even if you don't achieve it. We want values that actually express something real and differentiating from the rest of the world. So I put a second part of that, because this part is free access to knowledge. Is that something for which, you might say, libraries generally stand? And here's my argument, community ownership of knowledge. What does that mean? And here I am, actually, some of this is slipping into settings to think about legal issues. Because the ways in which information and knowledge work their way into the library environment are changing drastically as we approach the millennium. We're going from some fairly well-known ways that you acquire information and then share it with the public at large, ways that are governed by law, copyright, for example, which has particular exceptions, such as fair use, and we know we have no idea what it is and limitation. It's kind of mean, do your best and hope they don't want to complain. Okay. So we know about that, even if we can't stipulate to this. There are all sorts of new failures coming down. Failures enabled by the internet, by technology. And here's a question that I get into the comments. You think the library is kind of a common, the place that once the information is in there, it's available for people to come from all points and take a look at it. And you can see there's multiple facets really circling the same core value. And of course, it reflects my own views, but I actually offer the means of discussion. Here's another one, so what is this? There's students from bias. And if you go to yahoo.com and you type in something that gets it back at you, on what basis did it give you that answer? Now, one basis may be they really tried hard to give you an answer right at the question. Because after all, the more relevant they can be, vis-a-vis their competitors, the more often people will use them. So that gets you some knowledge, but that's not anything, because they may have other customers. You may not be the only customer. The customer may be somebody who wants to place an ad. And the ad gets shown when you do the search, and they get more money from that ad than they do from you arriving to do the search. So, how does Yahoo make its message? I don't know. Nobody knows. It's a trade secret, right? You ask Yahoo, what is it? I do. That's part of what makes them different. Now, I have some of them on some of the search engines. GoTo.com, for example, a recent IPO. Went very well, actually. That was the value, I think, on the first day. Goto.com formula is that it has an auction system that's quite open about those who want to have matches take place from places, suppliers of content. This is imposed by the next real show here. Suppliers of content. You know, if you provide you some content there, we think of this as like some amorphous gelatinous mass content that I guess. GoTo.com says we're going to take people at content launcher, sites that want to have people with it, and they can literally bid on users. So if somebody has some bicycle, GoTo.com has got to figure out who would pay the most to get a match for their bicycle. And that's how they do their matches. Now the public enraged over this, I don't know, I thought the public was really fun about it that much. In some sense, the public kind of really looks at something they want an answer. It might well be that the model they are bringing to these search engines is one they're bringing from a library environment. When they went to school or something, they went to the library, asked a question, got some pointers, and went on. But the values didn't carry over into the space. And you could actually see what the relevance to it, people starting to get more sensitive to, oh, I see. Maybe I can get a sense of using information free from bias. Now, of course, bias is a tough thing, right? We all have bias. This is a first modern world, and it says, if we don't have famous objectivity, so maybe we are going to exclude from all food and motives. Maybe that's what we're talking about. Somehow, at least you're not getting paid by the reader's guide to our literature to send them that way rather than some other direction. You might be biased, but at least it's not kind of a crass marketing relationship. I think that why does it matter? Why does it matter what they stand for? And this again borders on law. There's a speech property trade-off. The speech property trade-off. I believe there has been a fundamental misconception in our culture. The misconception is that intellectual property is property. Anything we know about property, like chairs and tables, applies to intellectual property. And there's a reason why this misconception, which is totally about the way framers intended it, has come about. Jefferson, at the time of the ratification of the Constitution, was greatly concerned about copyright laws. That was the part of the Constitution that even when read with the title of the First Amendment, clearly concerned speech, right? To create intellectual property, to say this is yours and you can't prevent somebody from copying it, is to say, no, I can't speak. There's a one-to-one trade-off. You can't have intellectual property without a restriction on everybody but the owner's speech. That's what creates the property. And Jefferson really liked that. Jefferson has some wonderful language, which I have in front of me, I will read to you. Basically about the nature of ideas. You can't keep those in front. There's one out there where they go from person to person, and when you give it away, it's not like you've lost anything. You still have the idea, and the person to whom you've given it has it as well. Now, again, this is a very simple thesis of a new revelation, and they're discovering this, and showing economic models that turn out that's true. Jefferson knew this and wrote it down and published it a while ago, and it turned out the idea had gotten around. His buildings were modified by a limited term, at that time, 7 years of exclusive monopoly, probably enough maybe be remunerated for your efforts to produce it, after which it goes into the commons. No legal claim, even to a literal copying of the very expression that he puts out. That term has since been extended somewhat, most recently last year, the Sotheby's Copyright Term Extension Act, passed by unanimous consent in the House and on a very close in the Senate, so nobody actually has to pick out eyes and maids, and they don't actually put your vote on paper. It passed in the Senate, and the term of copyright is now up to 95 years. And that applies retroactively, so those that were about to come into public domain are not coming into public domain. By the way, it's a greater higher center, my center, the Berkman Center, has a constitutional challenge to that, and for another reason, it's not a limited time that the Constitution contemplated, but it's promoting the progress of the useful arts and the sciences, which is what the copyright clause says the copyright is to do, particularly to give it to works that are creators. There's not much incentive to create when it's already there. It's not like you can make them create it again. So to do this retroactively is a very strange giveaway indeed. So Jefferson was worried that his words were modified by the limited term and by the fact that no matter how much you model a particular expression, ideas are still free. I think Jefferson was right at the time, has really reason to be worried today. And that was the compromise that I'm just mentioning. So in that 1994, here's the word for word an echo of Jefferson's view of the world. In that 1994, copyright owners looked at the internet and said, copyist copying, instant copying, perfect copying. This is terrible. Now what a disaster. Before you know it, stuff will get online and everybody will have it and they won't have to pay for it. There will be no information at all. And Dante Barlow, former lyricist of The Grateful Dead, from Cyberlist Thinker, wrote a wonderful piece called The Economy of Ideas in Wired magazine, in which he said, sure, I'm copyright is dead, I think I'm sure of that, but it's not doesn't matter, let's give it up. There's no way in this new network environment you can protect it. Once it gets out there, it's out there, so you can try, and sure enough, in 1994, there were attempts to tighten copyright laws to account for this new Xerox machine level quantum jump of the ability of information to jump around. Dr. Barlow, good enough, there's just no way, and that is bigger than all of you. There was another Internet 2000. The Internet is the turn of the millennium, it was a very different Internet from the Internet 1994. The Internet is the turn of the millennium. The Internet is the turn of the millennium is one in which, just last week, a new website came into being, trustedcc.com. Trustedcc.com is a consortium. So Packard, Compaq, IBM, usual suspect. So they have a trusted PC. Well, you might ask, is a trusted PC? A trusted PC is a device that can be trusted by the person who's putting information into it as against the person using it. So what is this? A trusted Netscape would be one to which you would send information, tag it, it says, do not copy this. In that case, it would say, all right, I won't. You can trust it. And the user received the information, highlighted it, edited the copy, and it's grayed out. So when the file is printed, it says, that would be 25 cents, please. Click OK to send another, have your credit card generated, and print. Print transfer, which means to print out print after all. Now, pretty much any system there is, you can hack it, but not everyone is a hacker. And to be sure, for 25 cents, it's not clear that you would upload all that effort. So you get into a sort of nickel and diming of information, a kind of unitization of it, which just wasn't possible before. And did I suggest maybe contrary to the kinds of values that are made by the Fifth Amendment, but even the Copyright Act? The Copyright Act is a balance set by Congress, so we give you these rights out there, but they're not total. The same is, for example, here in your library, is the first sale doctrine. That's a doctrine that says, if I am selling you a book, it's your book, you can lend it out to people, and even though for every person you lend it out, I'm losing a sale, because we're not buying it from you anymore, they're just borrowing it. You can do that. Copyright does not stop lending. Now, these trusted systems can be configured in any sort of way you want. You can configure a trusted system so it doesn't allow lending. So that somebody who is looking at the information can't just hit the forward button and send it on to someone else. You can never do a campaign for use. You only highlight three words of that piece in that space and say, I want to copy that. I have fair use for that. Come on, it's a big tone. The computer says, no, you can't copy it. You can't copy it. This is a new era of privatization. And it goes beyond even the licensing agreements you may be faced with as new kinds of software with information attached to them are working their way into libraries. But exactly how to deal with this is a good question. But it's still a debate that has been set over. It has not been fully engaged. So, what would the library 2009 look like? Is it going to be one for which, before you check out that book, you present your card that identifies and characteristics about who you are? And again, if you're a student card, you have one price. If you're not, you have a higher price. And what you get is not allowed to be shared automatically with others. And what role does the library have in saying, these are the kinds of deals, either licensing through contract or just through technology, the kinds of trusted systems we will allow into our book set? And indeed, to the extent that we're thinking about library online, you might be asking, what kind of library do we want to look like online? Will it be a library that requires a trusted PC on the other side in order to engage in people? Another problem, of course, is being anonymous. You never into a library, you just browse, you just browse. The new trusted system could require replication sometimes, and even for browsing, you're recruiting anything you're interested in. Now, I don't suggest there's anything particularly sinister about it. Sinister versions later send you junk mail based on your interest. But certainly in free society, there are issues about being able to read your own print. So here's an example right out of Harvard. This is a Matter Matters newsletter on a member of the team of commentators at Matter House. And this is what I read just the other day, 24th of September. Don't tell your network, this is for the students. You may originate a kind of business and develop an idea of some students to put that out there. Please remember this important statement on page 302 in the handbook for students. Like, how many students think that? Students who don't have to read papers or translations of more employed by students who are associated with companies may be required to withdraw. Very odd, isn't it? You see, the notes from lecture, then you should get a tell your notes. But it's sure, it's not like a transcription. This is not a copyright issue, right? You're paraphrasing. You're just taking your idea and you're putting it on paper. And if you should do it, tell us. You might have to withdraw. Now, if it's me, the paper for a day is essential degree, go to a school for your governor, you just tell us. Okay, you go out and say, I learned some stuff and now I'm going to tell you about it. Some lawyer or whomever. Now, I told them I'll tell this good fact. But this is that the test is in university, and DelphMock.com, it's not supposed to be .com, but their values are tied into realizing information is a gold mine, and it's one for which they should be posting fairly strict sentries at the entrances and exits. And anything that comes out of it ought to be approved by the university, ought to be filled by the university, and I'm sorry, students, you paid your money. I'm telling you to step into the classroom, but don't think you're taking it out with you when you go. So, I realize I'm running low on time. Let me make this the last slide. How can that stop you from driving? You have a car in a university or library environment. That's environment number one, faculty and university. The faculty and university realize that there is value being created here in the sense of what the faculty are generating through classes, through research, etc. And there can be disputes sort of who owns it, because who gets the profit from it when it gets sold. Faculty and university start the bargain and just develop up the pie. Now, really, there might be a third party to that bargain that then gets ignored, maybe the public at large. And it makes the university want to ask itself if it's carving up that pie, is this really what we want to be doing? Is this really what we stand for? If we don't do this, are we doing the bankrupt? You know, there are other models by which we actually make sure we pay our bills on time and grow, and then fill in any true value values we have. Popular faculty body number two, faculty university and sponsor. We see more and more of it, where somebody will come in with money to support research. Microsoft approaches MIT, so here's $25 million. It happened 2 weeks ago. There are other instances of studying sponsor research, but here's the term. We get this good double results. We get to say where they go later, and yeah, maybe 5 years from now, kind of like declassifying documents, you can release them to the public. Don't do all that copyright. We might extend that term. But you know, that's the value. You get money, you get research, hey, we're all in. Again, I think that's amazing, and one of the party at the table. The party that had an easy recourse to avoid, a voice that may be represented in this room, depending on the values of within the library establishment, that ought to be there. And finally, faculty member number three, what I call a simple joke. And this is when somebody says, well, that's too late for the library. I just put a CD-ROM research workstation there, and it's going to ask out the people to them. And here's a long list of terms, just fine at the bottom. No cost for you. It's just like having a paper in the corner. Indeed, it's like having a paper in the corner. So they're going to put queries in, they're going to get better, they're going to go to the library, you get foot traffic, you're getting information out, and you'll make the terms look better. In fact, we're even giving you a cut. How does that sound? And then we do it. How does that sound? So, this is a long way of talking about legal issues. So now that I hope kind of gives you the big picture and at least talk to us to ask, if not come up with a common answer, so what do we really stand for? But in the London term, I don't yet see library.org up on the net. I do not see a bridge representing dissemination of knowledge or public interest. Not to be afraid of the .com voice, less the .com voice, less the models. We don't need them. So not every bit is to be a shopping mall. And with that, not so bright top. I guess I will deal with the questions or see if the thought that we should just proceed to the next presenter. Thank you very much. And speaking of advertising, the website for our center is cyber.law.harvard.edu, and I welcome you to visit and see many of the projects we're doing which bear on the issues that I'm talking about. cyber.law.harvard.edu. Yes. Help source.
Yes.
I am not.
I'm just trying to say market websites from your institution and you can tell me how does my understanding work? And they will frame it with your institution around the web page.
It's kind of like these newsletters that the dentists would be told. You can send a newsletter to your patients and we'll give you all the content, but you can make it look like it's coming from you.
Yeah,
kind of
thing.
Well, certainly, if the information is being generated by one of the two parties, as long as they sign an agreement that says this is how we were represented, I don't know of any strong truth in advertising, that's what you're getting at, a kind of truth in advertising sort of thing,
yeah,
that would do it. Because, you know, for instance, when the New York Times puts out its paper, even if it doesn't use a byline, it's coming from a reporter somewhere, maybe they got it from AT or something, and they might have agreed with AT, you know that? They don't want to put the AT in parentheses anymore.